armed nations want Tehran to completely disassemble its civilian nuclear program, and states with vulgar colonial past do not want Iran to stand for the oppressed, those living under apartheid, and victims of genocide. Now, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the so-called talks with the United States are nothing but dictation under pressure. America's goal, he says, has never been a respectful diplomacy and engagement, but rather to, quote, strip Iran of its independence. And Ayatollah Khamenei added, only a strong nation can deter aggression and protect its dignity, warning that reliance on the U.S. or Western powers is a dangerous illusion. Let's first start with this quick report.
With the snapback mechanism set to take effect in a matter of days, tensions between Iran and Western powers led by the United States are reaching a boiling point. As Western powers seem increasingly reluctant to pursue diplomatic solutions and continue to exert pressure on Iran in an attempt to limit its legitimate rights, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has dismissed negotiations with Washington as futile, describing them as an effort to impose U.S. demands. He also warned that Washington's pressure campaign extends beyond the nuclear program, targeting Iran's missile program in an effort to erode the country's defensive capabilities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian addressed the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly, condemning three European countries for initiating a process to reimpose UN sanctions under U.S. direction.
The three European countries, after failing to bring down the proud people of Iran through a decade of betrayal and support for military aggression, attempted to reinstate the revoked Security Council resolutions against Iran under the directive of the United States through pressure, bullying, imposition, and clear exploitation. In doing so, they set aside good faith, circumvented legal requirements, portrayed Iran's lawful compensatory measures in response to the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA and Europe's absolute betrayal and inability as gross violations.
Despite mounting pressure, Tehran continues to emphasize its commitment to diplomacy and cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency, even in the aftermath of a war imposed by Israel and the United States. Now the ball is in the West's court. Will Europe and the U.S. choose dialogue to defuse the crisis, or will maximum pressure policies deepen the divide?
And now for your guests. Joining us, Mr. Masoud Shajadeh, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. And also joining us from London, Batul Subeiti, activist and political analyst. Hello, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Batul, we will start with you. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said the Washington's demand for Iran to dismantle its nuclear program completely proves U.S. is not seeking negotiations, but full surrender. Your initial take on that claim and the timing of it, as the Iranian delegation is in New York for this 80th U.N. General Assembly session.
Yes, good evening to you and your guest. The Iranian leadership has a very clear vision, and that is that negotiations with the United States are absolutely futile and should be treated, and as they are used, as a tool of deception that went to the extent of striking Iran in the midst of it. These negotiations cannot be trusted, particularly because they are not negotiations, but exactly as you mentioned in the question, a means of subjugation with their results predetermined. The goal is to impose these results, which involve the complete termination of Iran's nuclear project and going above and beyond that, because we know that the crux of the American issue with Iran is not the nuclear file. It is Iran as a model that represents complete freedom from the subjugation under American hegemony. And of course, America do not recognize, and the West for that matter collectively, they do not recognize the rights of the negotiating party here, which is Iran. They expect Iran to completely comply under its section whilst absolving itself, and further going on to strike Iran in the midst of it, actually keeping on its side of its agreement. And they do not adhere to the results of the agreements, and they abandon them at any moment as tried and tested. And as we know, worst of all, negotiations have been used as a deception tool preparing for a literal military assault on Iran. So this lack of trust makes these negotiations completely unwise, even naive or submissive for those who are engaging in them. And the crux of Sayyid Ali Khamenei's speech was to say how the strategy of the Iranian nation should be to strengthen itself internally. Whoever harms Iran is harmed back. Whoever conspires, threatens, will receive the like. Whoever hits, we will hit back. We need to look inwards and build the technological components that give us strength and deterrence, because the other side wants to leave us completely defenseless, as it's proven in the whole region. So America's threats, its force, its lack of compliance with every international law, its lack of compliance with basic morals, does not mean that Iran listens or cows down. Iran will never bow down to America. There should be someone in the world that says no to the arrogant and oppressive powers, and the leader says this without any hesitation. He doesn't walk with America to prevent America's anger or force, but rather this is the only language that the other side understands, and that is that if you conspire against us, we will conspire against you.
Well, very well said, Batul. Thank you. Mr. Shahjadeh, welcome to the program. Thank you for your patience. As the Iranian president reiterated once again that the UN General Assembly, Iran, through bona fide religious fatwa, is not after an atomic bomb. It's like beating a dead horse. I don't know how many times we have to go to this, like a broken record player, and mention this, but obviously we can't have a program, a sit-down like this, speak of Iran's foreign policy principles without talking about Iran's civilian nuclear program. Iranian leader just yesterday said that they know this, and he implied that they've known this, they've always known this, but they don't care. They want a pretext to impose their will, as Batul was saying, to thwart Iran's advancement scientifically, militarily, defensively, economically, until Iran is no longer independent.
Absolutely. And I think we need to realize what is happening around the world. Diplomacy is dead. International law is dead. Look, we have gone through right now almost two years of a genocide, which has been so visual, been beamed into our telephones, streamed into our telephones, TV stations, etc., etc. And international law and diplomacy has not been able to save one single life. This is not just about Iran. This is about the fact that we are sleepwalking into a future of genocide, future of no international law, in basic future, which is jungle, law of the jungle. And what is their offer? United States and the Western so-called nation are, it's nothing to do with justice, nothing to do with fairness, it's nothing to do with understanding that Iran has, as you said, over and over and over, saying that they are not going to go for nuclear weapon. As a matter of fact, if they wanted to, Iran could have had a nuclear bomb by now. And everyone knows that. You know, even all the intelligence agencies, their reports in the United States identify that. And they are a testimony to this fact. So what is going on, what is being created, is an illusion. An illusion because the United States wants to be the leader of the world, wants to bully everyone else. It's not just Iran and West Asia. They're even bullying the Europeans. I mean, you know, the sort of vision that we have, the photos that we have, how he set all these European leaders like in an elementary school and dictated to them what they should do. This is the reality of what's going on. And Iran, and under the leadership of Ayatollah Khamenei, is not going to give in to this sort of bullying, to this sort of dictatorship, and to this sort of policies. And indeed, what we saw from the president is exactly the same tone, the same understanding. As a matter of fact, overwhelming majority of Iranians understand this. I will go even further and say the overwhelming majority of people in the world understand this. But this illusion is being created, and they don't want to give it up. And I think partly is to do with the fact that we are seeing the end of hegemony of the United States, and the power of the United States is diminishing economically, and indeed it's not going to be long before it diminishes militarily as well. And this is where a dictatorship, a power, becomes very dangerous because it's trying to enforce his will when he hasn't got the real power. And I think this is all to do with those factors rather than wanting to have a negotiation, be it on the nuclear energy or anything else. This is not really the issue. The issue is that the United States, under Trump in particular, wants to bully the whole world under his command, and it's not going to happen.
Thank you there, Mr. Shahjada, for your initial take. And Batu, I'm going to come back to you. The leader noted U.S. has repeatedly violated its commitments, including the 2015 nuclear deal. It cannot be trusted. He said negotiations are under threat and coercion are useless and harmful, and accepting them will only invite further humiliation. Now, I'd like you to speak on that very last remark, further humiliation, Batul. Over 10 years of diplomacy to reach the 2015 JCPOA implementation, Security Council Resolution 2231, and the culmination of the JCPOA, gone overnight in Donald Trump's signature, presidential decree. Recent diplomacy to reach a new deal or understanding, you very well know, postponed for attacks on the country and its nuclear facilities. So tell me, if this isn't being a part of a deceptive plot and being played, what is?
Absolutely. Here the leader is outlining that this has been tried and tested. You don't have to drink all of the ocean to realize it's salty. America, as you've rightly mentioned, was the one who tore the deal in 2018. What is the point of negotiating, reaching an agreement as if it was properly reached? Then what's the point if in one pen everything gets terminated? You know, Trump does not comply. Those in power in America are obsessed with their power and the force that they can use. They are above every law. Guarantees has no meaning. An American president can come and take America out of all the international agreements that Trump doesn't like, including the UN Human Rights Council. At this rate, we're even going to see Trump, withdraw from the UN. So it's absolutely, as you say, that 12-day war in Iran raised doubts about the very legitimacy of negotiations, because it's become clear that America had exploited this diplomatic openness and used it as a deception to strike Iran. This demonstrated that the party confronting Iran, that is America and the Israeli occupation entity, uses all means, including diplomatic traps and deception, to achieve its goals without hesitation, without concern. They are deceptive in their nature. They are a maneuvering party that cannot be trusted, and Iran has a painful experience in this. So today, those who still call for dialogue and those who understand the futility of dialogue after the strikes have realized that following this 12-day war, the situation has completely changed. Iran right now cannot afford to be deceived again in the same way, despite attempts to lure it into that same diplomatic trap. It is clear that they do not want negotiations as a means to reach a solution. They want it to impose their conditions. And as Sayyid Ali Khamenei mentioned, they determine the outcomes of the negotiations based on the results that they want. So they want negotiations as a way to force surrender, not to find a solution according to international laws or the requirements of the IAEA, with which Iran, by the way, has signed an agreement and followed its terms to the T. So these terms have not been respected, and what was agreed upon has been torn apart by the principal signatory, which is America, without regards for the for the signed agreements or the results achieved. If there is no basic level of trust, negotiation in and of itself and diplomacy has no meaning whatsoever.
That's a really good point. And you know, Mr. Shahjada, that brings me to the fact that the U.S., they want Iran to be at zero uranium enrichment, right? And the funny thing is, to Batul's point, they had an agreement that they violated and they ditched, and it was the only deal that stopped centrifuges in Iran from spinning. They did that back in 2015, and then now they attack Iran's nuclear facilities. Please tell me how their policy and approach has worked for them. And before you do, let's also reflect on this. Back in 2015, as a result of the JCPOA, where was the percentage at when it comes to Iran's uranium enrichment? And since the U.S. opted out and they basically let the JCPOA go up in flames, where is it at today? And tell me how well U.S. policy has been working against Islamic Republic and its peaceful nuclear program.
It really is very clear. It's ample clear right now, if it wasn't from the day one. And I think to some people, including the leadership in Iran, this was clear even from the outset. And Ayatollah Khamenei indicated very clearly that he was never trusted America. I mean, now, and the fact that the United States cannot be trusted is so obvious, is so many sort of indication that United States have always broken its word, and it's been promising the world and delivering nothing. And it has done so not just in Iran. I mean, look at the implication of U.S. involvement in the whole region and beyond. It's brought nothing except suffering to ordinary people around the world. So this has been a ploy to defeat Iran's will of standing and being independent and standing against the aggressions which is being unleashed by the United States in the region and beyond. And it has not worked. I mean, the reality is that despite all their plotting and planning, despite all their sort of excuses and promises, Iran is stronger now than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And it's, you know, it's got a more capability when it comes to nuclear technology or indeed military technology. And economically, in every aspect, Iran, despite all the sanctions, despite all the plotting and planning by the whole Western nations against Iran, Iran has not just survived, but has become stronger and more able and more capable. Iran has now mastered 60% enrichment, and it could very easily, everyone knows, could take that far beyond that. And Ayatollah Khamenei said it very clearly, that we have the knowledge and we have the capability and we have the technology, but we don't want to have a weapon, but we are going to continue our progress in technology and capability. And Iran has shown that it's able to do that. It's doing it. You know, every year you look at the progress in Iran. This is a testimony to the policy of Iran, and it also shows that the policy of United States and the Western nation are bankrupt and are being defeated year in, year out.
Thank you. And Batu, at the beginning of the program, Mr. Shajad has said that diplomacy, unfortunately, is dead. And when we look at the events in Gaza and in Palestine, we kind of feel the fact that the world hasn't been able to pull together and give Gazans some reprieve, that perhaps it is dead. And then when we look at Masoud Pezeshkian, the Iranian president today, said the U.S.-Israeli aggression against Iran showed is a betrayal of diplomacy. And then another failed diplomacy example is triggering the snapback mechanism. The Europeans that did nothing towards the preservation of the JCPOA post May 2018 Donald Trump withdrawal are now all of a sudden eager to invoke the snapback mechanism against the Islamic Republic. Yet here is Iran time and again approaching the negotiation table, showing its will to talk, showing its will to be flexible and open. Why is the other side showing Iran nothing but a brick wall?
Right. So you've spoken about a few of the landmarks in the region. I mean, the future direction of West Asia remains very uncertain, but there's one fundamental principle that holds, and that is that power determines survival, and those who lack strength will not endure, including, by the way, the Israeli occupation entity. Any actor that proves that the region does not belong to America will end up asserting itself, prompting a Trumpian response of withdrawal. So we need to understand that it is the force on the ground that imposes itself and the power balance. And actually, the West will be forced to negotiate with those who they realize that the power balance on the ground is in their favor and that their strength cannot be overcome. Of course, in the case of the Islamic Republic of Iran, this is the attempt to completely break its leg and to shake its foundation as the principal anti-imperialist actor in the region, but actually globally as a model also to fight Western hegemony. So in light of the unclear picture of where things are headed in this very volatile region, and in light of the comprehensive Israeli impunity and the American green lights, we have to always stress this, that it is Trump and it is America right now that is granting Israel a complete free hand to do whatever it wants in order to achieve its hegemony over the region as a focal point for American presence there. So the absence of Israel or the lack of Israel's strength would threaten all of the American interests in the region, because it means that the resistance has the upper hand and the guardian of American hegemony, that is Israel, would be in a weak and retreating position if it fails to achieve results, which explains the maximum force and brutality that we are witnessing on the ground. So the situation in the region remains very unstable and anxious, moving towards escalation. And this over here, it's very important for Iran to have strength, and that strength is built on its internal components and its inherent strength, as opposed to being some kind of reliance on the outside or the, you know, the removal of sanctions as the position of strength for Iran. It has to be internal.
All right. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Time's gotten the better of us. Masoud Shajad, their chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, and also Batul Subeiti, activist and political analyst, both of them joining us from London. Stay safe, and thank you both dearly. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
For more than seven decades, a single wrenching fact has shaped the politics and the conscience of the Muslim world. The occupation of Palestine and the denial of the Palestinian people's basic rights by the Israeli regime. That occupation is not treated by many across the region as an isolated dispute over territory. It is seen as an ongoing injustice with a moral and religious core, a wound in the body of Islam that demands attention, redress, and above all, solidarity. From Tehran's perspective, that solidarity is not optional. After the 1979 revolution, the Islamic Republic enshrined in its own legal and political DNA a commitment to the oppressed wherever they might be. Iranian leaders frame their foreign policy not simply in terms of strategic interests, but in terms of principle. The principles of the Holy Quran, the obligations of Muslim Brotherhood, and the duty to defend the vulnerable. This is not presented as a rhetorical flourish. It is written into the Constitution, and it has driven Tehran's choices on the world stage ever since. For decades, Iranian leaders have declared it their duty to wrest Palestine from the grip of the occupying Israeli regime. But the question is, why does Iran consider itself as the guardian of the Palestinian cause? Iran's argument is straightforward. If Islam defines community by faith rather than by land, if membership in the Muslim Ummah is a matter of belief, then the duty to defend fellow Muslims extends beyond borders. Citizenship under this view is secondary to conscience. When Muslim communities are dispossessed, when their homes are bulldozed and their children fall victim to bombardment, the Islamic Republic insists that the rest of the Muslim world cannot look the other way. Mr. Hassan Lasjerni, managing director of Khabar Online, which is one of Iran's most influential news agencies, joined us for the discussion.
In foreign policy, when a nation defines its principles, they stem from several sources: history, culture, religious beliefs, and historical experience. with the Islamic Revolution and even before it, Imam Khomeini outlined broad guidelines. Chief among them was defending the oppressed and resisting oppressors. These values are deeply rooted in Islamic teachings, where the emphasis is on resisting injustice and protecting the vulnerable. This is central to why Iran stands with the Palestinian people.
Islam lays out clear rules on matters of war and defense. One important principle, especially relevant in situations of invasion or occupation, is known as defensive jihad. This isn't about initiating conflict, it's about protection, resisting aggression, and stopping an enemy from taking over Muslim lands politically, militarily, culturally, or economically. According to the majority of Muslim scholars, this responsibility isn't limited to the community under direct attack. Instead, it extends to all Muslims who share the duty of defending their brothers and sisters until that defense is sufficient. Until then, the obligation remains on everyone. This is the lens through which Iran explains its steadfast backing of the Palestinian cause. In the words of the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, raising the issue of Palestine for the Islamic Republic is not a tactical matter, it is a fundamental matter born of Islamic belief. It is our duty to free this Islamic country from the domination and grasp of the usurping power and its international backers, and to entrust it to the Palestinian people. This is a religious duty, the duty of all Muslims. All Islamic nations, all Islamic governments are obliged to do this. This is an Islamic duty. We also welcomed Mr. Nasser Abu Sharif, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad's representative in Iran, who shed light on Tehran's role in backing the Palestinian cause.
Iran has supported the Palestinian cause across all fronts. The country consistently advocates for Palestine in international forums. Its foreign policy has always placed Palestine at the center. In addition, Iran promotes the Palestinian narrative in opposition to Zionist and Western propaganda. Iranian media have played a crucial role in exposing the criminal foundations of the Zionist regime and shifting global public opinion. Iran has also provided vital backing for Palestinian resistance in their struggle against the illegitimate Zionist regime. While the West has tried to demonize resistance as terrorism, Iran has emphasized its legitimacy.
At a time when many Arab politicians remain silent in the face of the Zionist regime's occupation, a voice rose from Iran, one that not only broke that silence, but showed a new generation of Palestinian fighters the path of resistance. Imam Khomeini, from the earliest years of his movement, regarded one of the main reasons for his opposition to the Pahlavi regime to be its overt and covert alliance with Israel. Mr. Abu Sharif contrasted two different schools of thought on supporting Palestine, that of the Arab world and that of Iran.
At the outset, there was little difference between the Arab nationalist project and the project of the Islamic Revolution regarding Palestine. For example, the late Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser made Palestine the central cause of the Arab world. However, his framework was Arab nationalism, not the Islamic identity of the broader Muslim Ummah, which became the foundation of Iran's Islamic Revolution. This is where Iran's revolution proved stronger. It was not based on ethnicity or nationalism, but on Islam, which unites all Muslims. In 1968, at the Arab League summit in Khartoum, Arab leaders declared three no's: no peace with Israel, no recognition of the regime, and no negotiations with it. Yet within a few decades, many Arab states abandoned these commitments. By 2002, they put forward a two-state plan that effectively recognized Israel alongside a Palestinian state. Later, they even moved beyond this and pursued normalization with Israel. In contrast, the Islamic Republic of Iran never deviated from its commitment, defending Palestine as a matter of justice, humanity, and politics.
From the very creation of the Zionist entity and long before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Islamic groups and revolutionary fighters in Iran considered the liberation of Palestine a central objective. Religious authorities and activists, guided by Islamic principles, felt compelled to respond. Ayatollah Kashani was among the earliest to protest the Zionist occupation, urging people to rally in support of Palestinians and opening an account at Bank Milli to collect donations for their aid. Ayatollah Brujerdi, then head of the Qom Seminary, also spoke out following the establishment of Israel in 1948 and the ensuing war with the Arab states. But perhaps the most important figure who opposed Israel's occupation of Palestine was Imam Khomeini. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, he linked his struggle against the Shah's tyranny and American colonialism with a broader fight against Israel and a defense of Islamic interests. As early as the 1960s, he declared, "We are prepared under all circumstances to defend Islam, Islamic countries, and the independence of Islamic nations. Our program is the program of Islam, the unity of the Muslims, the union of Islamic countries, and brotherhood with all Muslims." Throughout the world, alliances with all Islamic states exist in opposition to Zionism, Israel, colonialist states, and those who exploit the resources of poor nations without compensation. Mr. Lasjerdi then raised a provocative point, an issue he argued often subject not just to interpretation, but to outright misinterpretation.
The famous statement that Israel must vanish is often misunderstood. Some interpret it as purely a call for military confrontation, but from within the Islamic Revolution's perspective, it's not limited to military means. It's also civilizational. The idea is that Zionism as an oppressive project is unsustainable in the long run, politically, morally, and culturally. The struggle is therefore broader than armed conflict. It's about ending a colonial structure at every level.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini publicly condemned the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel as a betrayal of Islam, Muslims, and Arab brothers. His support for Palestine and Lebanon grew stronger, expressed in meetings with the public, diplomats, and Palestinian and Lebanese fighters. The pinnacle of his anti-Zionist stance was the creation of Quds Day. He designated the last Friday of Ramadan as an international day of struggle against oppression, tyranny, and Zionism, a symbolic and enduring call to stand with the oppressed. Our conversation also featured Mr. Hossein Kanani Moqaddam, a well-known Iranian politician and seasoned expert in domestic affairs.
As early as 1963,
Imam Khomeini described Israel as a cancerous tumor that must be resisted. During the Pahlavi era, especially under Mohammad Reza Shah, Iran maintained covert and overt ties with Israel, military, economic, and cultural, though it never formally recognized it as a sovereign state. After the revolution, everything changed. Iran became a state bound by international frameworks, but Imam Khomeini declared Quds Day, signaling open opposition to Zionism and support for an independent Palestinian state. This policy continued under the current leadership, consistently rejecting the two-state solution endorsed at the UN because it connotes the recognition of the Israeli regime.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Tehran Times: Palestinian referendum unveiled at Baghdad Book Fair. The book Palestinian Referendum, outlining the views of the leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei on Iran's proposed solution to the Palestinian issue, was unveiled at the Baghdad International Book Fair during a conference titled Palestine and the Conscience of Humanity. Opening the ceremony, Dr. Abdul Wahab Al-Razi, chairman of the book fair, hailed the event as a source of pride, describing the work as connected to the scholarly, intellectual, and humanitarian personality of Ayatollah Khamenei. Mohammad Al-Hafi, head of Arab and Islamic relations at the Hamas office in Iraq, paid tribute to martyrs from Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran before recalling the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini's 1978 declaration of support for the oppressed, particularly the Palestinians. He said the new book reflects the continuation of that legacy, stressing that Palestine remains central to the thought and action of Ayatollah Khamenei. The Credo. Iran rejects Arab Islamic Summit's call to recognize Israel. The Islamic Republic highlighted its historic stance that a two-state solution cannot resolve the decades-long occupation of Palestine and called for the creation of a single democratic state. Tehran, on 16th of September, released its observations and reservations regarding the final statement from the extraordinary Arab Islamic Summit held in Doha a day prior, rejecting the two-state solution and ruling out any prospect of recognizing the state of Israel. Iran stresses that the so-called two-state solution will not resolve the Palestinian issue, the statement said, adding that the only genuine and sustainable solution is the creation of a single democratic state established through a referendum with the participation of all Palestinians, both inside and outside the occupied territories, representing the entire Palestinian people. On this basis, we dissociate ourselves from any references to this concept and similar notions, including East Al-Quds, the 1967 borders, and etc., contained in the communique. As for the recognition of the Israeli regime, Iran reiterates that joining the consensus on this communique should in no way either explicitly or implicitly be construed as recognition of the Israeli regime, the statement adds. Iran urges Islamic regional nations to join boycott campaigns against Israel. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Esmail Baghaei has called on regional and Islamic countries to sever economic and political ties with Israel, describing the regime as occupying, genocidal, and terrorist. Speaking at his weekly press briefing in Tehran, Baghaei said that normalization of relations with Israel equates to legitimizing crimes and aggression. He noted that the global tide is shifting, with several countries, both within and beyond the Islamic world, already cutting trade and diplomatic relations with Israel. Baghaei stressed that Iran remains committed to fostering indigenous security in West Asia, independent of external players whose interests, he argued, lie in safeguarding Israel. The Guardian. UK, Canada, and Australia announced formal recognition of Palestine with a wave of Israel's allies to follow. A wave of Israel's allies are announcing their recognition of the state of Palestine as part of the wider maneuver designed to challenge attempts by the Israeli government to erase the chance of a Palestinian homeland. The UK, Canada, and Australia formally declared their recognition of Palestinian statehood on Sunday in separate but coordinated statements. The move marks the first members of the G7 advanced economies to take this step. Portugal announced this move late on Sunday, too. Paulo Rangel, its foreign affairs minister, said, "The recognition of the state of Palestine is the realization of a fundamental, constant, and fundamental line of Portuguese foreign policy. Portugal advocates a two-state solution as the only path to a just and lasting peace. A ceasefire is urgent." Other countries also joining the list of 147 UN states that recognize Palestine are Belgium, France, Luxembourg, Malta, and possibly New Zealand and Liechtenstein. The other nations made their formal announcement on Monday at a special UN conference to revive the warning cause of a two-state solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
The Iranian Constitution itself lays out this mission. Based on Article 152 and 154, defend the rights of all Muslims and support the oppressed in their struggles against the oppressors anywhere in the world. In other words, Palestine isn't just politics, it's a legal and ideological mandate. The country's constitution lays out clear principles on this issue. Clause 16 of Article 3 states that Iran's foreign policy must follow Islamic values, uphold solidarity with Muslims everywhere, and offer steadfast support to the oppressed. Article 152 emphasizes defending the rights of all Muslims. And Article 154 goes even further, declaring that Iran seeks humanity's happiness, recognizes independence and justice as the right of all people, and while avoiding interference in other nations' internal affairs, supports the struggles of the oppressed against oppressors anywhere in the world. Mr. Kanani Moqaddam emphasized that Iran's steadfast support for Palestine is beginning to pay off as the movement gains traction worldwide.
Istiqlal Azadi va Jumhuri Islami.
The Islamic Revolution's core values, independence, freedom, and Islamic governance, come with costs. Confronting imperialism, Zionism, and colonialism requires sacrifice, but surrender is far costlier, as seen in Libya, where compromise led to destruction and loss of sovereignty. Iran's support for Palestine is thus not only a moral stance, but also a strategic one. Importantly, global solidarity with Palestine is growing. Academics, artists, activists, and even governments worldwide are speaking out. Recent aid flotillas toward Gaza, for example, show that defending Palestine is no longer confined to the region, but has become a global movement, and you cannot ignore the vital role of Iran in keeping the Palestinian cause alive across the world.
In line with these principles, Iran has put its policies into action through a wide range of political, cultural, and military measures. These include but are not limited to creating the Quds Force, expanding the role of cultural attachés abroad, and introducing Islamic Unity Week. On a military political front, Iran has also played a supportive role for groups such as Lebanon's Hezbollah, Palestine's Hamas, Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, Yemen's Ansarullah, and others.
Arab nations often approach Palestine through ethnic, tribal, or nationalist lenses. Since Israel's creation in 1948, leaders like Jamal Abdel Nasser led various struggles, but results remained limited. Analysts argue that after the Islamic Revolution, resistance against Israel gained an ideological and religious dimension. Even Arab nationalists and leftists drew inspiration from the revolution's slogans about the oppressed and against tyranny. This transformed the Palestinian struggle from a largely nationalist cause into one infused with religious conviction.
For Iran, this isn't just ideology, it's also national interest. Tehran says it cannot simply tend to its own affairs while overlooking Israel's illegitimate dominance in West Asia. Security, it insists, isn't built by fences or treaties alone. Iran's borders, in its view, extend beyond lines on a map, and protecting its national interests means supporting resistance far beyond its frontiers. It's important to note that the Israeli regime's aggression isn't limited to the Palestinian people. Its hostility toward Iran and its citizens, for example, has left a long and dark record, including the assassination of scientists and prominent figures, acts of sabotage, the arming and backing of adversaries, and other malign actions against the Islamic Republic. Confronting this fraudulent and criminal regime, therefore, is not only a matter of standing with the oppressed in Palestine and Lebanon, it is first and foremost a direct defense of Iran, its people, and its national interests. Mr. Abu Sharif went further, acknowledging that without Iran's backing, the Palestinian cause might have slipped into obscurity.
While much of the world abandoned Palestine or tried to erase it from the global agenda, Iran remained steadfast in supporting resistance. This perseverance has helped sustain Palestinian resistance. Recent polls confirm a generational shift, especially in the West. For example, a Harvard survey found that among Americans aged 18 to 24, 60% expressed support for Hamas, and 83% backed the Palestinian people against Israel. The trend is visible even within U.S. politics. 83% of Democrats and 63% of Republicans opposed Israeli policies. Such numbers deeply alarm Western governments and Israel. This transformation is the result of two factors: Iran's consistent support for Palestine, and the steadfastness of the resistance itself, even under brutal Israeli assaults. Without Iran's backing, it would have been far more difficult for Palestinians to maintain their struggle.
Some nations have offered support to Palestine, but only in fits and starts, their commitment fleeting. Iran stands apart. It is the one country that has never stepped back, never wavered. And for that, it has paid a price, politically, economically, militarily, and on the world stage. Pointing to the recent summit in Doha, Mr. Abu Sharif noted that Iran is shouldering the heavy burden of maintaining an independent stance on Palestine.
At a recent Arab-Islamic summit in Doha, although no binding measures were adopted, the rhetoric was telling. It is now widely understood that Israel, not Iran, poses the real threat to the region. For years, the U.S. and its allies tried to portray Iran and the resistance as the danger. Today, even Arab states aligned with Washington see that Israel's aggression and Western dominance are the root of national instability. Yet many of them remain unable to act independently, as their decision-making rests in Washington, whether in the State Department, the Pentagon, or the CIA. The Islamic Republic of Iran stands out as the only state making sovereign, independent decisions, which is why its position on Palestine has remained firm and consistent, even after October 7th.
Israel and its allies often try to paint Palestinian resistance as terrorism, and those who support it as supporters of terrorism. Western media networks and certain global organizations have been key tools in promoting this narrative. Yet the reality is that Palestinians have a legitimate right to resist, including armed resistance and international law often drafted by the very Western countries that back this regime affirms this right. Supporting a people under occupation and oppression is likewise considered lawful under these same frameworks. Under international humanitarian law, Additional Protocol 1 to the 1947 Geneva Conventions explicitly recognizes national liberation wars as a protected right for peoples under occupation. Mr. Abu Sharif offered a striking observation. Iran's anti-Zionist discourse not only strengthens Palestine's position, but ironically could also benefit the United States, a country entangled in the grip of Israeli lobbying.
I want to thank the people of Iran for their patience and sacrifices in supporting Palestine. The path they have chosen is difficult, but it is the right path, and its fruits will be rewarding. Iran's support has not only defended the Palestinian cause, but has also confronted projects of domination by the West and Zionism. This is not just about Palestine, it is about humanity. The struggle is one of life and death, not only for Palestinians, but for the whole world. Even in the U.S., some recognize this. A professor at Columbia University once remarked, "Palestinians live under occupation and know it, but Americans live under occupation without realizing it," referring to the deep control of Zionist lobbies over American politics. Studies show that around 20% of the U.S.'s most critical institutions are under Zionist influence, with complete dominance in some sectors. No one can become president without the approval of these lobbies. Therefore, resisting Zionist influence is not only a service to Palestine, but also to the American people themselves. Only by confronting this source of corruption, as Zionism has proven to be worldwide, can nations, including the U.S., hope to reclaim independence and justice.
Yet in today's world, roles of victim and aggressor are often inverted. From a Western perspective, Palestinian resistance fighters defending their homeland are labeled terrorists, while countries supporting them, like Iran, are accused of supporting terrorism. Meanwhile, supplying thousands of tons of bombs to the Israeli regime, resulting in thousands of deaths of Palestinians in the past year alone, is hailed as a hallmark of the free and civilized world. Mr. Kanani Mogaddam linked the latest attacks on Iran directly to its commitment to Palestine, arguing they follow the failure of Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign.
From the Islamic Revolution onward, Iran has faced continuous sanctions, first from the U.S., later from Europe and others, precisely because of the support for Palestine and the resistance front. These sanctions, whether under the Amato, Katsa, or EU measures, have targeted Iran's economy, trade, and energy exports. Yet even under maximum pressure, Iran has showed incredible resilience. The 12-day war, orchestrated by Israel and the US, proved that beyond economic and political pressure, a military dimension of confrontation is also unfolding against Iran, mostly because of its support of the resistance movements in the region.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
Greetings, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's a preview of what's coming up next on your trusted radio station. Up first, take a moment for thoughtful reflection with Hadith of the Day. Next, we turn to Islamic laws with Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of the prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Following that, join us for Africa Today. For those seeking to deepen their connection with the Holy Quran, don't miss Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, it's the Hadith of the Day. Stay tuned.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the Day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day, where sacred words meet sincere hearts of yours. Today's episode is built around a hadith that challenges our emotions, our alliances, and even our politics. Comes from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, and narrates from the Messenger of God, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny. Whoever loves for the sake of Allah, hates for the sake of Allah, gives for the sake of Allah, and withholds for the sake of Allah, is among the most sincere of believers in the sight of Allah. Beware, when two believers love one another for the sake of Allah and are loyal for His sake, they are like one body. If one part suffers, the other feels its pain. This is reported in classical sources, including Al-Kafi and others. So let's reflect on what this means. We live in a world full of conditional relationships. I love you as long as you agree with me. I support you as long as it benefits me. I give, but only when it's useful. But the Prophet gives us a different measure. Do you do all this for God? Not for popularity, not for tribe, not even for your own comfort. So loving in God means loving those who walk His path, even if they are unpopular. Withholding for God means refusing to support injustice, even if it benefits you. And being one body means you feel the pain of others, not just those in your circle. Interestingly, science supports this level of unity. Neuroscientists have found that humans literally feel the pain of others through what's called mirror neurons. When you see someone suffer, especially someone you care for, the pain centers in your own brain activate as if it's happening to you. But what makes someone close in your brain? Not just blood, shared meaning and values. So when believers love in God, not in blood, ethnicity, or language, or other things, that closeness becomes real. The Prophet's words, like one body, aren't just poetic. They're neurologically accurate. So this hadith also gives us a compass in morally confusing times. Sometimes giving to someone we like may not be right. Staying silent in the face of wrong may benefit us, but displeases God. So the Prophet says, the true believer gives and withholds not based on favoritism, but on divine values. You support truth no matter who speaks it. You stand against injustice, even if it's done by your own. You don't love someone simply because they share your language or passport. You love them because they reflect the light of God. So is that true for you, about you?